The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu. Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. If you love Atlanta, you can invest in the big picture. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
From WABE in Atlanta, welcome to this edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Coming up with today's program, it's now revealed Atlanta will have to kick in at least $20 million more for the public safety training facility. That's despite what the city had always been claiming it would only cost about $30 million. I'll speak to one of the journalists who crunched the numbers to come up with that additional $20 million plus. And the Black Enterprise Disruptor Summit gets underway today here in Atlanta and runs through Sunday, June 4th. You'll hear more about the goal of the summit. And speaking of small businesses, Clark Atlanta University has a new program to expand opportunities for Black entrepreneurs throughout the South and Virgin Islands. Oh, important conversations coming up. But first, we'll get to this news. With just days to spare, the debt ceiling legislation is finally headed to President Joe Biden after the Senate's approval via a bipartisan 63-36 vote. However, Georgia Republicans in Congress were divided on the vote to suspend the debt ceiling this week. The split underscores fractions among the party, as we hear from WABE's Sam Greenglass.
Six Republicans backed the deal to avert a default. Three voted no, mostly ultra-conservatives who often campaign on ideological purity over compromise. This vote breakdown isn't an apples-to-apples illustration of bigger fights within the party, like the fight over former President Trump and his false election fraud claims. For example, pro-Trump Marjorie Taylor Greene broke with her hard-right colleagues to back the deal. Next week's Georgia GOP convention underlines a more clear-cut rift. The Georgia Republican Party remains hitched to former President Trump. Meanwhile, Governor Brian Kemp has distanced himself from Trump and the state party and won't appear at the GOP convention. Trump is a featured speaker. Sam Greenglass, WABE News.
An Atlanta Citizens Board that oversees police conduct says it's still looking for a resolution after it was blocked from interviewing some detainees. We have more from Shemaine Cruz.
The Fulton County Sheriff's Office rents beds at the Atlanta City Detention Center to relieve overcrowding at its own facility. But the Atlanta Citizen Review Board says it was recently told it would need to obtain a court order or permission from an attorney even to interview the city's detainees with complaints against the city's officers. Samuel Reed is the executive director of the Citizen Review Board. He says the board decided against a memorandum of understanding with the sheriff's office that would set rules for interviewing people in its custody.
There was no issues with that process, and so we're still trying to figure out what was the purpose of changing this process.
The sheriff's office said it made the changes after finding that an investigator with the board tried to interview a detainee in its custody. Shemaine Cruz, WABE News.
Georgia is now in hurricane season. June 1st marked day one for the Atlantic region, and officials are encouraging residents to be prepared, as we hear from WABE's Melissa Fato.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration predicts an average 12 to 17 named storms for 2023. Coastal communities and low-lying areas inland are vulnerable to storm surge and flooding. Even Metro Atlanta can be affected by strong winds and heavy rain as hurricanes and tropical storms move inland. According to NOAA, tropical cyclones have done as much as $20 billion of damages in Georgia over the past decade. State Insurance and Safety Fire Commissioner John F. King is urging residents to check their home insurance coverage now. And the Georgia Emergency Management Agency suggests making a family plan before a storm approaches. Melissa Fato, WABE News.
Finally, historically Black colleges and universities, which include some here in Atlanta, are experiencing an increase in donations from U.S. companies. As Julian Virgin reports, a new analysis says that's largely due to Black employees.
Education researchers say donating to HBCUs is a new trend for corporations. The increase in gifts in recent years has been encouraged by Black employees. Some HBCUs have received renewed attention amid the racial justice movement following the 2020 killing of George Floyd. Since then, Atlanta's Morehouse College has received nearly $76 million in total donations for racial equity, including $30 million from Mackenzie Scott, Jeff Bezos' ex-wife. Spelman College has seen an increase in donations as well. According to a 2019 philanthropic study, the average HBCU received 178 times less funding from foundations than the average Ivy League school. Julian Virgin, WABE News.
And you're listening to Closer Look.
Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. You can go beyond giving to impact. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
And Closer Look continues from WABE here in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. Time now for another installment related to Atlanta's police and fire training facility. Initially, it was believed between the City of Atlanta and Atlanta Police Foundation, the city would kick in about one-third of the $90 million projected cost. But reporting published last week from the Atlanta Community Press Collective reveals the city's cost could come out to over $50 million or higher. And this all comes as the City Council was scheduled to vote on the funding this coming Monday. There's a lot to unpack with this story, so joining me now is one of the reporters in the Atlanta Community Press Collective, Matt Scott, no relation, could be, who knows? You look like my cousin, I don't know.
Could be.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
How long have you been part of the Atlanta Community Press Collective?
A little over a year now for me. The Atlanta Community Press Collective itself was formed in 2021, sort of in the wake of the signing of the lease of the Public Safety Training Center, or COP City, as I'm going to continue to call it. And then I joined last year to help out with some of the history projects and then started to do more of the day-to-day reporting and covering of city council.
And you like to do a lot of research, obviously, and read a lot of numbers and contracts and all that, apparently.
I did not think that reading how City Hall works or reading through contracts was going to be something that I enjoyed so much, but here I am pouring through open records requests, you know, several times a week and just enjoying every moment of it.
I know a lot about open records requests. Let's start with some numbers. Now, Atlanta Mayor Andre Dickens' administration has consistently shared that the city's share of the $90 million going toward the center would be about $30 million, about one-third. Now, your reporting found that figure is expected to be at least into the $50 million range or higher. I want to start there. That's correct, right?
Yeah, so now we know it's $67 million.
Okay, so let's back up, because as you know, as a journalist, we got to
build to it.
Build to it, and see, you can do this. Well, you ain't going to do this show, but you know. So let's back up. How did you all... What information did you all need before you could come to this?
So it did start with an open records request, and the community part of Atlanta Community Press Collective really came into play here. There's a community member who really enjoys also doing open records requests, and we're in contact pretty frequently. And so they sent me this request from late 2021 to early 2022 between the City of Atlanta and the Atlanta Police Foundation. Mm-hmm. And as I was reading through these emails, just about 2 months after the lease legislation was signed, there's a conversation between Marshall Freeman, the chief operating officer at the time of the Atlanta Police Foundation, and John Keene, the chief operating officer for the Bottoms administration at the time. And they're discussing this new plan for a $55 million COP city. $20 million was going to come from a leaseback agreement payment, so $1 million a year for 20 years, and then a $35 million perhaps bond referendum or some sort of lump sum payment.
Now, the training center, and I understand you can refer to it, that's what you want to do. That's fine. I'll allow you that. But the training center here, as it goes back to that initial press release from then-Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms and the City Council approved the land lease to the Police Foundation, it said, quote, the city's contribution will be through a 30-year, $1 million per year lease starting in fiscal year 24, or a single contribution through a general obligation bond. Close quote. Now, that may be a little like what to some of our listeners, so let's make sure I'm understanding this. Am I understanding correctly then that that legislation being voted on Monday would allow for both a one-time and annual contributions to take place? Is that right?
That is correct. This legislation, if signed, authorizes the mayor to enter into this leaseback agreement. So it authorizes first $30 million and then an additional $1 million in a lump sum payment. And then it authorizes a 30-year leaseback agreement that's going to come at a cost.
And that's on top of what the city initially said. So we're already looking at potentially $60 million.
Exactly.
I know my math. Well, my math teacher would be very proud of me right now.
I don't think we got into this to do math, but it keeps coming up.
Yes. So let's go back a little bit behind the scenes, because how much time went into putting together all of this, Matt? I mean, it's a lot of numbers here. And look, as journalists, we're supposed to do this. We're supposed to go through, read. People think sometimes you sit here and you just read. No, we research, we read. So how much time were you all combing through all of this?
So I started working on it the week that the legislation was introduced. That's when I was sent the initial open records request from 2021 and then started to put things together. So over the weekend and then into Tuesday, when I had enough confirmations through contacts at City Council that this was actually part of the conversation, that this was likely to happen, that's when I started writing. So I spent about 6 hours putting it all together, mm-hmm. you know, in form, and then we had a great community effort in the collective to edit the piece and put it all together and put out that video package that went along with it.
Did you seek comment from Mayor Dickens' administration about these new numbers that were sort of coming to light?
Yes, I sent a request to every member of City Council and to the mayor's office, just asking for confirmation that mm-hmm. this leaseback agreement payment was part of the conversation.
Did anybody
respond? Nobody responded back to me.
That kind of happens to us too as well.
It seems frequent.
This story also covered the role of the Atlanta Police Foundation in lobbying and meeting council members and to get them on board with the project. That's nothing new. I mean, that happens. But I want to take that a little bit further, because the role of the foundation, which is obviously important here, but they've not been very vocal about, I mean, they leave everything to the city or Mayor Dickens or council members to speak upon. Have you had any luck in trying to get the... I think I know the answer to that, but...
We have not had much luck. I've submitted, actually, open records requests to the Police Foundation for the most recent budget for the Training Center project. I had absolutely no response from them, and that is what we're seeing across the board, really, with media.
Matt, in the open records request that you all, the information that you all receive, is there any indication that the Atlanta Police Foundation was trying to make sure they had support from city council members? Did you have that information?
Yeah. So in those,
which is not, wouldn't be surprising.
In those 2021 emails between Marshall Freeman and John Keane, there's conversations about having to get city council on board and having to build support. And I believe it was John Keane that said, we can expect a little bit of pushback from this. So they were planning on building support in city council to get this done back then. And now we've seen in more recent records requests that they're setting up luncheons and breakfast with city council members.
There being the Atlanta Police Foundation.
Yes, the Atlanta Police Foundation, in particular, Dave Wilkinson, the president and CEO.
Yes, CEO of the Atlanta Police Foundation. I want to back up a little bit to also, have you been able to, again, in what you all have received, any opposition, clear opposition from city council members or anybody in the Dickens administration in response to these memos going back and forth and folks getting together for lunch or what have you?
We have seen no opposition. Of course, you know, there are council members who are vocal against it.
But nothing in terms of
Bakhtiari, but there's nothing internal in the open records request that we've received that would indicate much pushback beyond what we already know is there.
How many folks are in the Atlanta Press Collective?
It's about 8 people right now. There's some volunteers that come in and out. So it's we're looking at expanding and growing our coverage.
How many have training as a journalist?
We are all community trained. My background is in history, mm-hmm. Which turned out to be pretty applicable in the skills that I picked up in my history program come into play every day mm-hmm. here. But there's no formally trained journalist in the collective.
And you stand by, obviously, you stand by what you all have reported. There has not been anything that I've seen in terms of that would counter that your information is incorrect so far.
It is my goal to have everything be fair that we do report. Of course, we have an opinion and a perspective, but the reporting that we put out, I stand behind on its factual basis.
You all first reported this story, I think it was last week, Wednesday, it's 24th, and the AJC followed up with confirmation from city officials, I think 2 days later, while referencing your work. That probably had to make you feel good.
That did make me feel good. It was the first sort of reference that we had in the paper of record for
the
city of Atlanta.
You trying to make us look bad, Matt?
I would never.
No. Well, first of all, I stand by our reporting here at WABE.
And Emily, it's been great reporting, and I do applaud you for how much reporting you've done on this topic.
Look, I give props where props should be given. Then the AP picks it up, I mean, through your lens. And I say that a lot. I get emails. People say, stop saying it. I don't pay attention to them. What does it say about what outlets are seeing as legitimate and trustworthy?
So I think that that's actually an interesting reflection on what's going on in Atlanta today in this media scene. There is this rise of independent media that is sort of filling the void left with the AJC not critically engaging in topics like Cop City. So it says a lot about this new wave of media that we're seeing drive a lot of these narratives.
I have a listener who has a question here to ask about, will the city generate any money off of this? And understand this too, that this is the city was going to be paying for use of this facility. Am I incorrect?
The city will be paying for use of the facility. With that leaseback agreement, they would, in theory, be able to rent out the facility. Those terms are not clear, and they continue to say that there are no current plans to do so.
But there's some speculation that perhaps this will go beyond training for Atlanta's fire and police, that it could be national training for other entities, other organizations.
Yeah, through open records request, we have emails of conversations between members of AFR, the Atlanta Fire Rescue Department, and the Atlanta Police Department, and the Atlanta Police Foundation about rental rates for a similar facility, the Georgia Public Safety Training Center down in Forsyth County. So they've been having conversations about what they can expect to get for fair market rental rates for the facility.
You feel y'all's reporting has been fair? And balanced?
I would say it's been fair. We believe that we have to acknowledge that we come at this from a position, and in order to properly engage in the topic, acknowledge that position.
Do you all consider yourselves, like WABE, we're a public media, we're a news outlet, you know. How do y'all see yourselves as more of a community-based? So you have a position.
We have a position. I would say that we are a news media outlet.
Mm-hmm. With the position.
With position. In there's history for this, the Great Speckled Bird in the 60s and 70s.
I know who you're talking to,
right?
I would
love for us to be in line with that.
How are you all funded?
We are funded right now through crowdfunding. We're on the Open Collective platform. And we also have various foundation funding coming in.
Are your books all in order? Because I don't want you all to get...
Our books are in order.
Right, accused of something, you know, just checking.
I would be surprised if they come after a member of the media, but I at this point, you know, if we're arresting bail funds, it's really a question of how far are they willing to take this.
Matt, what else are you all working on over there? That you can tell me.
That I can tell you. There is a piece, there's been a lot of conversations about at a Public Safety Legal Administration Committee meeting. Councilmember Lewis.
Antonio Lewis,
mm-hmm. correct. Was engaging with Police Chief Darren Shearbaum about the use of gang charges, mm-hmm. Saying that he had members in his district, in District 12, that were charged with these gang charges that shouldn't have been. And then recently there's a group that releases audio from police scanner traffic. Mm-hmm. And there was the funeral for the, I believe, 12-year-old girl or 15-year-old girl who was killed the other
at the graduation party at Mays High School.
Yes, and there's audio of the police talking about wanting to charge individuals attending the funeral with gang charges. So that is my next story.
Mm. Matt Scott is a journalist with the Atlanta Community Press Collective. Thank you for your time. Thank you for sharing how you all went about doing this reporting. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Closer Look continues from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. Coming up in just a moment, we'll hear about a new program at Clark Atlanta University for entrepreneurs. Meanwhile, the Black Enterprise Disruptor Summit gets underway today here in Atlanta and runs through Sunday, June 4th. It's an effort to help Black business owners. There will be forums, networking opportunities, and even a pitch competition. So ahead of the summit, I spoke with Alfred Edmond Jr. He's the Senior Vice President and Editor of Black Enterprise. Alfred, thanks for taking the time. I really appreciate it. Congratulations. You just got a big promotion, right?
Yeah. It's good to know that I'm still relevant and valuable to the company after 36 years and counting.
Now, I know all about Black Enterprise, but it might be some folks who say, hey, what's Black Enterprise? Tell me about this long time. I call it just a media conglomerate now.
We are a multimedia, multi-platform media company. We started out, we're still best known, though we don't do print media anymore, but for the Iconic magazine founded by our late founder, Earl Graves Sr. So we were, the number one Black magazine for business and finance and investing and careers for the first 45 years or so of our existence. We're now in our 53rd year, but of course it's spent probably the last 20 years transitioning to become a multi-platform digital media, live events, virtual events company, doing premium content as well as daily business news and other content for African Americans who want to succeed financially. Our tagline is wealth for life.
Yeah. And you all have had to shift and change how you disseminate information and engage with folks because we're in this whole digital space right now. What has that transition been like for you all over the years? Has it been kind of smooth?
No, I don't know any media company is still standing that will say it was smooth. We just understood it was necessary. I give all kinds of credit to our current CEO, the son of the founder, Earl Graves Jr. Derek Dinglicher, current chief content officer, were among a generation of then younger executives who saw that the tide was turning and that you saw spending decline in print and other traditional media and increase in digital media. We started pivoting really back in the early 2000s. It was not an easy transition. You talk about culture change. It was just very challenging, but we stuck through it and made it through. And the Black Enterprise brand is so strong that most Black people can't imagine a world without it.
Yeah.
And that really helped us to sustain ourselves until we came out. Now on the other side is the number one digital media brand for African Americans.
Yeah, and this summit is described as 3 days to connect, collaborate, and celebrate. How did all this begin? You all saw a need to have something to bring not just, you know, entrepreneurs, small business owners, innovators, inventors, everybody.
Yeah, we've been in the events business, you know, now for close to 30 years, maybe more. Going back to the original Black Enterprise Entrepreneur Summit, we used to do a golf and tennis event, we used to do a ski event. But the goal of all of our events, whether they're in person like Disruptor Summit in Atlanta, June 2nd through 4th, or whether it's virtual, because now we do a lot of virtual events online, is really to bring people together because, as you mentioned in the lead into this interview, the emphasis is on the access. When we talk about a lack of access to capital, the problem really isn't lack of capital, it's lack of access. So our mission is always to bring people together, to create those relationships, to bridge those gaps so that people can get that access they need to the capital that exists.
You know, we're not out of the pandemic, but, you know, we're not at the height that it was, you know, let's say 2021. And so are you all hearing from folks saying, listen now, you know, even with inflation and everything that's going on, we have some other barriers and some other obstacles as well. So, you know, we need a little guidance as we move into how the rest of the world is navigating. And, you know, there's that saying that when America gets a cold, Black folks get pneumonia. You know, because it trickles down, it's usually worse or whatever it is.
Well, here's the irony, though. First of all, because Black entrepreneurs are used to operating in climates of adversity, it's only different degrees of adversity. Right. And it's one of the reasons why Black entrepreneurs are among the most innovative, because Black people have to be innovative. We have to learn to do less with more. We have to make our talents and our gifts go further. We have a tendency toward leaning toward excellence because anything less than that will put us out of business. So that's a strength. Here's the other interesting thing, though, as we talk about, you're right, COVID hasn't ended. It's just the shutdown has ended. COVID forced a lot of innovation. We're seeing a lot of interesting Black-owned businesses that got started or got accelerated because of the conditions of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And what Black entrepreneurs and others in that space, whether you call them founders, entrepreneurs, creatives, the Disruptor Summit is meant to be a tent for all of them, is that we recognize that when there's challenges, there's also opportunities. And we just see a lot of, especially young entrepreneurs, taking advantage of those opportunities. And it's our job to help them succeed.
Now, I know you have guest speakers. In fact, you have two people who've been on this program before. You have Slutty Vegan founder Pinky Cole. And then you have my man Mason Wright, team founder, entrepreneur of Mason Superdogs. I've interviewed him. He's a wonderful young man. So from that, you know, a teenager, and then to someone like Pinky Cole, and you have some other folks, there's something for everyone here. Who is this Disruptor Summit really also trying to engage?
Well, obviously, if you're already in business, the goal is to bring together resources from large corporations that want to do business with smaller entrepreneurs, as well as fellow entrepreneurs. Again, to connect the dots, to give you the relationships you need to move your company forward, to help you achieve your goals. One of our models is that everybody in the room has a piece of the puzzle, but if you don't bring everybody together, you'll never find the piece that you need. So it's really for existing entrepreneurs, but this is also really for those aspiring entrepreneurs, those people who, whether they did it by choice or because of or by circumstance, because to the term disruptor, COVID disrupted a lot of people's lives, and they began to look at new ways of living and making a living. So if you're someone who's a young business or aspiring entrepreneur, this is a great place for you to kind of jumpstart what you're doing and not have to reinvent the wheel. You can meet people who've already done it and accelerate your ability to get your business off the ground.
I probably shouldn't ask this, but I'm going to ask it. Why Atlanta? I mean, you know, Atlanta influences everything, according to our good friend, Bim.
Well, Atlanta has been established for a long time, for several generations, as a really great environment for Black entrepreneurs to come together. It's a vibrant, probably only second only to maybe Chicago, in terms of just a vibrant Black entrepreneurial landscape, especially in tech, especially in media and communications, but not limited to those areas. So even if you don't live in Atlanta, people who work outside of Atlanta still see Atlanta as a great place to go to have these conversations. Mm-hmm. We've had many Black Enterprise events there over the years, and it just felt like the Disruptor Summit, this was a good place to bring it for the first time.
And I understand, Alfred, there is a pitch competition.
Yes, now you're in my heart now, because I
got a pitch for you, and I've been pitching this for years, and it goes nowhere. I want to start a hotel for wayward cats.
I think in this space, here's the key. You got to figure out who's going to pay for it. But the pet industry is so hot right now. People love their pets. You might be able to have a business model that makes that work. But yeah, the Disruptor Pitch Competition, and I've been a national pitch competition judge for many organizations over the last 30 years, is really not about just about the money. Up to $15,000 will be up for grabs for the finalists who come to pitch in Atlanta. We've been doing that for over 25 years or something similar. But what we try to do with our pitch competitions is to leverage the fact that, again, I want to go back to access. Mm-hmm. We still have to cultivate generations of African-Americans who know what to do when they get in the room with somebody with money. Mm-hmm. So it's knowing how to have that conversation, getting those relationships that you don't normally have access to, knowing how to make the case for why your company is investable. What's in it for the investor? And pitch competitions are a great way for entrepreneurs to learn that.
So let me ask you this. If you can give a gold nugget here, what do people tend to do? And I hate saying do wrong, but what do you want to advise folks against when they're in a pitch competition or they're in that room with the folks that can write that check?
I will use a quote from our late founder, Earl Graves. He says, "Sell to their needs, not from your needs." Too often, if you're not used to pitching your business, you pitch it from the standpoint of what you want, what's it's going to help you do, but how it's going to help your business grow. When you really need to get into the minds of what's in it for the other person, generally, if it's the investor, you want to make a case for how will this make money for you if you invest in my business.
So I need to say, look, I know y'all tired of all these stray cats coming up on your porch and in your garden. I'm going to come and take these cats and give them a home.
What an investor cares about is, I found a way to give them a home that will create profit. And if you invest in this, you get a cut of that profit.
I will train the cats to be Hollywood cats, to be in movies.
That might be, yep.
And acting.
What every investor wants to know is, where does the money come out? If I put my money in,
yeah,
where does the money come out? And how much of it do I get when it comes out?
Wow. How often do you have to tell people that?
I mean, usually after I do a lot of mentoring. So after a couple of mentoring sessions with me, they kind of learn the language. But you got to think, suppose somebody came to you and said, listen, I want you to put $10,000 or $15,000 in my business. Mm-hmm. They would have to tell you something that would make you feel comfortable about getting that money back with a profit. Mm-hmm. And if you could really focus on what's in it for the person whose investment you are seeking, you're way ahead of the curve in terms of getting a chance to get that money invested in your business.
And we brought up the pitch competition. I've got emails already. Folks say it's still too late to register for the pitch competition.
I don't think so. So I would say go to blackenterprise.com today. Register for the Disruptor Summit. You have to be registered to the summit to enter, because we're selecting the finalists from people who are entering the event.
Wow.
I am one of the judges, so I'm kind of giving you some free game in terms of what I'm going to be looking for. But yes, it's not. You go to blackenterprise.com and Disruptor Summit. You'll see it in the drop down and you'll learn more about, the deadlines.
And often, and Alfred, I know it's not lost on you when we hear that so many businesses fail within that, between the 3 and 5 years. It used to be 3 and 5 years. I don't know if it's the same, but and we don't like to talk about why businesses fail, but it is important for folks to understand that it's not always just because of lack of revenue. It could be folks just not understanding how to properly run and operate a business.
Well, I tell entrepreneurs, first of all, don't be so hard on yourself. Most successful entrepreneurs, the ones that we celebrate, if you look into their history, they started businesses, they sold businesses, they started businesses, the businesses failed. You know, if you're an entrepreneur, you outlive your businesses. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I think we give Black entrepreneurs a hard time because it is 3 to 5 year, but that's typical because not every business is meant to last beyond that point. What's more important is that you learn from each experience, because the most successful entrepreneurs learn from their previous businesses and they build that experience into the big business that they're celebrated for and successful for. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's true. Sometimes it's not the entrepreneur's fault at all. Some businesses just, the life cycle ends of that business ends, and you just need to accept that the way you might accept that, you know, a flower that you planted didn't last forever because they weren't meant to.
And we've had conversations on this program during the pandemic where we saw a lot of Black-owned businesses by Black women being, you know, started, and in the Latino community as well. Are we still seeing those numbers at the top in terms of who's coming online in terms of small business ownership?
The fastest growing entrepreneurial groups remain Black and brown women. That has not changed. And I don't think it's likely to change in the near future. Mm-hmm. One, because when you talk about the lifestyle flexibility that people look for in entrepreneurship, women lean toward that because they often have to play multiple roles in their families and their communities. The other thing is, though, women are still facing a lot of barriers in corporate America. So they're far more likely to realize, you know, I'm not going to go much further in this. So I'd rather invest in my own dreams and what I'm doing. So it's kind of a double-edged thing. Some of it is because, again, they want to do it for the flexibility. Some of it is a perception of opportunities in corporate America and other places, and they eventually decide to do their own thing. But yeah, the irony, though, and you spoke to it earlier, they're the fastest growing entrepreneurial class, but they're also getting the least amount of capital, which is unfair. So that's one of the things we challenge all the time at Black Enterprise.
And you all will talk about that during this Disruptor Summit.
Absolutely.
Alfred Edmond Jr., the Senior Vice President and Executive Editor of Black Enterprise. Black Enterprise's Disruptor Summit takes place here in Atlanta, June 2nd through the 4th at the Grand Hyatt Hotel. For more information, we'll have a link on our website, or you can visit their website as well. Alfred, thank you so much for taking time. I appreciate it. I'm going to work on that pitch for my home for Wayward Cats, and somebody's going to invest in that soon.
Keep me posted.
I got you. I appreciate you.
My pleasure.
Y'all better stop laughing at my idea for Wayward Cats. Closer Look continues now from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. Keeping in the spirit of helping entrepreneurs, Clark Atlantic University is investing in entrepreneurs by giving them resources, not just students, but alumni and faculty, everybody. And if you want to own a business, they're going to help you out, we think. Now, the CAU Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurial Development was already a resource, But recently, through a partnership with PNC Bank, the university launched a regional center for entrepreneurship, which aims to support Black business owners. And the university just appointed the Southern Regional Director of this new National Center for Entrepreneurship at CAU. It's a familiar name because she's been a regular contributor to Closer Look over the years. It's me. No, just kidding. It is Dr. Nsinga Burton, an award-winning journalist, entrepreneur, scholar, and thought leader. Been on this program so many times. Welcome. A new chapter for you.
A new chapter. Thank you so much for having me, Rose. Totally appreciate you.
So you've been in higher ed for...
Ever.
Okay, I didn't want to say that, but okay. A new chapter. Why now?
Yeah, well, you know, I've been in academia for 22 years, and I decided that I wanted a new type of experience. I wanted to help students, faculty, staff, and the communities that we connect with and are part of in a way that was different than in the classroom. Mm-hmm. So I've been an administrator. I've been co-director of several programs and things of that nature. But I decided that I wanted to use my skill set, my talents, and not leave 22 years of teaching on the table and bring that in as well. And, you know, I'm a serial entrepreneur, mm-hmm. And I've also been an executive director before for the National Association of Multicultural Digital Entrepreneurs. So, and, you know, in pivoting, I had to decide what it was that I wanted to do and go after. And luckily, Clark Atlanta University and the HUPNC National Center for Entrepreneurship chose me.
And let's be really clear, because we are starting to see a lot more of HBCUs really come up with programs that are embedded in the community. Mm-hmm. And this goes back in the day, as they say, our uncles and aunties, when small business owners, Black business owners, were so crucial to the community.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, entrepreneurship is part of our foundation. You know, we didn't just sit back. You know, there's a dominant narrative where it's, you know, they say post-Reconstruction or what have you, after the end of slavery or the antebellum era, however you want to term that, mm-hmm. That, you know, Blacks, you know, they just didn't know how they were going to make it. That is false. We absolutely knew how we were going to make it. We had done a lot of, if not all of, most of
the work. We had no choice because
right?
We had to make work.
Right.
In our,
right.
We had
no, come right. on now. Exactly. So we built businesses. We had, thriving communities that were wiped out. If you talk about... Greenwood, or which is also known as the Tulsa Massacre mm-hmm. of 1921, and all these other things, you know, and then, you know, also, you know, people were not helpful in helping us to build our businesses or maintain them. So, you know, in the Jim Crow South, they were creating, you know, retail or merchant retail organizations that you had to join, but you couldn't join if you were Black. Mm-hmm. You couldn't operate your business legally if you were Black. And so that really played into dismantling a lot of our entrepreneurial interests, along with all of the other things that we have overcome to get here in 2023.
And this Southern Regional Center, this is something, it's part of a bigger or a national center, which is located on the campus of Howard University.
Oh, right? That is correct, right? Yeah. So we have the Howard University PNC Bank National Center for Entrepreneurship, which was launched in 2021. The center is aimed at building resources and support for Black business owners, i.e. entrepreneurs, mm-hmm. across the country. And the center is looking to help businesses expand opportunities for Black entrepreneurs and to enhance the educational leadership and capacity building resources and programs nationwide.
And when you think about the role, particularly here of Clark Atlanta, mm-hmm. and where it's located, obviously on the west side of town as well, that is going to be so crucial, not only for the community, but in trying to preserve the history of that community, of those neighborhoods, because they are embedded in Black businesses, or at least the history was.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Clark Atlanta has an amazing history of entrepreneurship. You know, they're celebrating 75 years of the illustrious School of Business this year. They have several programs. You know, they were selected to be the head of the global HBCU headquarters for innovation, the Propel Center. Mm-hmm. They have the very impressive Mandela Fellows Washington program that they do every year. They've been doing that for 15 years, where they invite what they call YALI, Young African Leaders. Mm-hmm. And it's Young African Leaders Institute is why it's called YALI, which is also an African word. but they invite people from all over the country to come and learn about, you know, leadership, servant leadership, right? Getting more information, building your businesses, expanding your businesses, entrepreneurship, all of the things that you want to know and need to know about. So Clark Atlanta has been thinking about ownership, innovation, and creativity for a long time, and leading the pack, quite honestly, for a long time.
And they have a center over there already, as I mentioned, coming to the segment now.
Yes.
There's always got to be a first, so you're the first regional director.
Yes.
What are you going to be tasked with? I mean, just not just overseeing, but you have some specific strategic initiatives that you want to get launched?
Yeah, absolutely. We're working that out now. I'm working on my first 100 days. But, you know, I obviously want to capitalize and collaborate and bridge all of those pieces that are already in place. And then actually help them serve as a model for other HBCUs that are in our region, although we have fantastic HBCUs in our region who have a great tradition of that, too. But one of the things that we want to do is to make entrepreneurship, demystify entrepreneurship, right? To make it accessible to others, to develop a curriculum that's not only for students, but also for members of the community, to host events, you know, where people can actually learn how to start a business, the basics, the nuts and the bolts, how to scale their businesses, because scaling businesses is something that's very difficult for Black-owned businesses for lots of different reasons. And then also how to create, you know, that generational wealth, right? Mm-hmm. And how to leave something for those who come behind you.
So basically you all can be an incubator from the concept to the launch and everything in between. And I've said this before because we've had conversations where people talk about, yeah, you have a great idea, but so many businesses, you hear this term, they fail within, it used to be 5 years, and now I've heard 3 years, and I've even heard 2 years. This is really about getting folks, for those who are starting a business, let them understand the basics first.
Yes.
So we don't have to get to this, okay, my business failed in the first 2 years.
Yes.
What are some of those, you think, issues most? There are challenges that predominantly impact Black business owners, startups.
Yeah, I mean,
other than capital, because we always hear about capital.
Well, that's the first thing, is the access to capital, right? First of all, you have to demystify the process. You know, you can start whatever business that you can start, as long as you can provide whatever service or product that you are advertising, so to speak. But yeah, it's access to capital. It's also access to resources that are available, whether it's, you know, applying for community grants. You know, it doesn't have to be huge, like $88 million, like PNC Bank. It can be $88,000. You know, it can be other numbers. But really finding out where those other sources are that are available to you, not only in your community, but on your HBCU campuses and other, I would say, academic campuses as well. But definitely, you know, access. People need to learn how to scale their businesses. Scale, it means that you are basically growing your business so that you are actually growing the capacity of your business to not only make money, but to also serve you, right? People don't talk about that part of scaling your business, right? Because it's important, because you have to grow, right? At some point, you can go run stagnant. You always need to be finding a new audience for your product or service. You always need to be thinking about adding people to your businesses. You know, many people are what we call now solopreneurs or sole proprietors. And, you know, even though Black women are killing it in the entrepreneurial space, most of us self-fund our businesses. And so if you can scale your business, then you can actually put money in your pocket. You can leave something for those who are behind you. And you can have that kind of generational presence and that generational wealth. As opposed to if you are taking every bit of money you get and reinvesting it back into the business.
You've been on that side. So what
I am on that side.
You're on that side, yeah. I mean, Burden Wire, too, by the way. If you don't know about the Burden Wire, check it out. What were some of the learning curves for you?
I mean, you know, we just celebrated our 10th anniversary. Yeah. So, you know, the learning curve is you got to let go. Right. So when you have your own business, and, you know, I think anybody can relate to this, you have the idea, you're the person who's putting in the sweat equity, in addition to finding the original money, in addition to finding the original staff, in addition to doing your accounting, your taxes, all the things. And so when you reach a certain level and you become really focused on a very particular business model or a way of doing business, it's really hard to let that go. But you have to let it go to bring other people in so that you can continue to grow the business. And that was my hardest lesson.
And look, if Cousin Henry does not have an accounting degree, he should not be taking care of your books just because he can. He said, I can do it for free. That's not what we want.
No, no. Well, you know, whenever you do budgets, right, you know, I produce and stuff like that, you have to figure out where you're going to put the bulk of your money. Right. So you want to be putting your money and your income and your profits and your losses, because there will be those in the beginning. You have to be able to sustain yourself through those. You have to be able to put them where it needs to go in order for you to make the most money that you can, so that you can save some and invest some, save some and invest some. And so that's some of the things that we're going to be doing at Clark Atlanta University. Right. It's like, hey, this is a great idea. Yeah. You've been selling these T-shirts or whatever for this long. And this is your audience, and this is how much money you've made for this point of time. What's next? Do you want to continue doing this at a greater level? Do you want to pivot into something else? Like, what specifically are you trying to do, and how can we help you find the resources, find the cultural capital, find the human capital, all of those things to make those dreams come true, but beyond dreaming, but, to really maintain our foundation and to continue to grow as a community.
And how often will you all be checking in with the other centers? Because there are other centers. So, and you're going to, since this is the new one here, you will be looking to see, hey, what y'all doing over there?
Oh, yeah, we talk every week. So, there's a standing call. We share ideas. We get information. We have Aaron Horn McKinney, who is the national director of the Howard University PNC National Center. And so she's very good at keeping us communicated. She's a two-time Bison communications person. So she's very good, degree holder. So she's very good at communicating information and keeping us connected so that we can collaborate and model best practices for each other as well.
What have you been hearing so far from folks who are either excited about this or folks say, hey, I'm just a small business. I'm not a student, but I can still come on campus and you all can help me?
Well, it's funny when I tell people, because, I just started.
You just got here.
Yeah, I just got here. But when I tell people about the position, it's like, oh, I know Rose, and Rose needs to get this information. Or, oh, my daughter is at Clark Atlanta University, or my son is at Morehouse College, or what have you. You hear that, oh, yeah, my best friend's, my godchild is at Florida A&M. This is going to be great. So you hear not only about what this initiative can do or the center can do for students and faculty and staff and people who are in the community, but also how we can bring other people what they need in order to grow as well.
When you, and I know you've seen these numbers before, and it talks about they call it the black buying power in the United States in terms of the amount, and it's in billions, way in the billions that black folks spend on non-black owned with businesses. Look, there are some things that are just out there. So when you look at that number, it's way up in the billions. And then someone says, okay, now how do we make sure we get that to trickle down to, I think we stopped saying minority owned businesses, but, BIPOC businesses. Initiatives like this are part of this. Is there a how do you gauge the effectiveness of that this is working? It could be 10 years. It's not something that you all can gauge year from now.
Well, you said that,
and I call you back. Hey, how many black businesses y'all launch? That's not a
right. Yeah. Well, that's you said the optimal word, gauge, right? So this, what's great about these centers, and all of them, the centers at Clark Atlanta, Texas Southern, Howard University, and Morgan State, is that they are academic institutions where data is important, right? So it's about more than saying, hey, I'm doing this, but we're going to be doing research as well. Not only research to provide to people who are interested, but also for ourselves so that we can see how effective we are. We call those measurable outcomes, right? So how many people do we actually help start a business? How many of those businesses are still standing, 2 years later, 5 years later? How many people applied for this resource that we offered? How many people showed up to our pop-up HBCU hub? How many people showed up to our launch? What did they take away? How many minority and women certified businesses have we gotten helped, obtain in the last, 2 years? All of those things.
And I stand corrected because I'm looking at my notes here. It's actually, as they call it, black buying power, projected to reach $1.8 trillion by 2024.
Well, let me say this, too, because I kind of want to change this narrative that black people spend money everywhere than with black people. That is not true.
Okay.
We actually have, and there's a Pew Research study that came out recently that talks about nearly 6 in 10 black adults say supporting black businesses or buying black is an extremely or very effective strategy for moving black people toward equality in the United States. We absolutely buy black. So we're like a small yet mighty group, right? So only 3% of small businesses in the U.S. are African-American. But out of that 3%, we spend more, we have more than 1.3 million workers. That means that we are feeding families. We're putting food on the table. We're helping people live the lives that they want to live and succeed. And we are bringing in and adding $42.2 billion per year to the actual economy as well.
Well, here's what's interesting out of all that with those numbers, because if folks should understand this, when we talk about black spending power, that's great, 1 point whatever trillion.
Yes.
But what about the net worth?
Yeah. Oh, that's another show, Rose.
I know. I need some more minutes. Which is goes back to why.
No, but if we have more entrepreneurs, then our net worth will increase, right? And so we're not saying that you got to only spend your money with Black people. I mean, you should try very, very hard, because in the United States, how you vote is with your dollars in a lot of cases. But what we are saying is that every time you do so, you help support a Black business owner. You help feed a Black family. You help create a legacy. And CAU's ethos is find a way or make one, right? Mm-hmm. Make one. And that's been that, since it was Atlanta University, right? But make one means creating something. And entrepreneurship is what that is in its essence, right? Finding a way and making one is building a business to support you, your family, your community, and the generations to come.
Here y'all go. Rose, when is this going to open? Because I'm ready.
It's open. We will be getting information out ASAP. We're excited. We have 28 schools in our region, and we are excited to bring them together. We're excited to go to them. We're excited for them to come to us. All of the things. So we are open. We're ready for business. We got the shingle out. We are modeling what we are doing.
The Rose Scott Home for Wayward Cats is coming soon, 2024. Dr. Nsinga Burton, recently named the Regional Director of the Center for Entrepreneurship at CAU. Best of luck to you. Thank you so much for taking time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And some breaking news into Closer Look. I want to let you know, this is a statement from the Board of Education, from Chairwoman Ishay Collins. The Atlanta Board of Education has decided not to extend the contract of Atlanta Public Schools Superintendent Dr. Lisa Herring beyond June 30th, 2024. The board and Dr. Herring remain committed to the students, families, and employees of Atlanta Public Schools. Again, the Atlanta Board of Education decided not to extend the contract of Atlanta Public Schools Superintendent Dr. Lisa Herring beyond June 30th, 2024. And that's it for this edition of Closer Look. Our producers are LaShawn Hudson and Daniel Razel. Tiffany Griffith is our supervising producer. Our engineer is Sawyer Vanderwerf. But today, Daniel Razel was back there on the boards. A reminder, let me know your thoughts on today's program or any other. Send me an email, rose@wabe.org. Stay tuned to 90.1 WABE Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Local, state, national politics. WABE and NPR have the coverage you need. I'm Jim Burris, host of WABE's All Things Considered. Whether it's on the air at 90.1, streaming online, or connecting through our mobile app, WABE keeps you on top of election 2024 in what's sure to be a pivotal year in politics. And for candidates and ballot information, visit our election hub at wabe.org/election2024.